crazy, great, big, long equation. I've got it built into my Hewlett-Packard 28S calculator that all I've got to do is plug in the exact value of the starting impedance, resistive and reactive component. I tell it three pieces of information, the exact impedance I start off with, the Z0 of the line that I care about, and the length of that line in degrees. That's just the way I do it. Could have done it in wavelengths, but I do it in degrees. And for instance, your 0.15 lambda just happens to be, when you multiply by 360, 54 degrees. So I would plug in 54 degrees, and then my calculator goes through this complex mathematic equation. It's got about six or seven terms to them, all in complex. And a fraction of a second later, it gives me the answer on the screen, which after the 50-ohm line, 0.15 wavelength, I have 33.75 minus J24. And you had rounded it off on the Smith chart to 34 minus J24. Close enough for engineering purposes. I mean, the manufacturer told you 100 ohms, J0, nothing exactly 100 ohms and nothing exactly J0. Even that's an approximation. So I've developed the confidence of this equation approach because I get a little bit more accuracy. But of course you can make errors. And when I want to be double darn sure and I'm about to commit a lot of resources to a particular project, I back it up with a Smith chart. Actually, I want to see it swung with a compass on a real piece of graph paper and see that the answer comes out darn close, if not find out why not. Sometimes when you see it on the Smith chart, you realize that, gee, I could have put a stub a little bit sooner on the other side, use an open circuit stub, and occasionally you'll see that. So each has its advantages. But I think what you did with the Smith chart is the right way. K2KEY, KQLIW.
Very good. This is K2KEY. All right. This was one particular problem. Now you brought up another point that I had. Well, I touched upon it last week. They asked me about, solving SWR by that quadratic method, where I got that the quadratic method formula for solving, SWR and all from measurements taken. If you can, taking a measurement at the antenna, if I can quickly can do, by that method of solving the SWR. All right, then there was a question that came up about, again, polar, changing this over to polar form, or polar notation, as we may call it, and why and where, and, the vector relationship of determining the angle of scalar magnitude of impedance, I guess that's the correct way to actually to describe it. It's actually what we call scalar magnitude impedance and the phase angle and how this fits into it. But basically, before I would go this far, I would honestly say that's what I always do. Sketch it out. If you sketch it out on the Smith chart, you get a good visual of what you're going to, in other words, if you do it mathematically, it doesn't come close to this. You say, oh, I did something wrong math. It's all great, like Dick said. It's excellent. First, sketch it. Then you get an idea, and then if you want the real definitive answer, right, for the math, it's going to come out very close. Now, about putting it to polar form, that's another situation completely. I don't know if we should, go that far. I think I touched upon polar form or polar notation in the past, Dick, over.
Yeah, funny you should mention this one, because 2 weeks ago, a buddy of mine from Dallas, Texas, mailed me a color photograph of a check that a friend of his in Dallas had mailed to the Verizon Communication Company. And this man was so angry at Verizon, he said a couple of pieces of profanity on the check, but he made the check out for an amount of dollars equal to 0.002 plus e to the I pi plus summation sign from n equals 1 to infinity of 1 over n squared. He literally wrote that down in the upper right-hand corner of the check, where you put down the number of dollars, and he rewrote that out in the section where you normally write out the number of dollars of the check. And as I said, he also put some other profanity. Obviously, the guy was pissed. But what he's really doing is he's got first an infinite series part of the mathematics. He's got exponential polar form mathematics, that's e to the I pi, plus a fixed constant of 0.002 dollars. And when you work out what this means, it's a very interesting answer. So converting something like 100 plus J0 is an easy one to convert from rectangular to polar. That's the rectangular form, where normally the horizontal axis is the resistor, that's the 100. Normally the vertical axis is the reactive, that's the J0. And so that one's a fairly easy one. When you plot that out, the line will be straight to the right, the arrow will be straight to the right, there is no vertical component to it. And so you could say it is a 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, that's the magnitude, or 100 ohms, if you want it in ohms, at an angle of 0. That one's an easy one. But for the what you get after the 0.15 lambda of coax, you can read that angle off the Smith chart. I think Mel's going to teach us how to do that. Or if somebody told you, like Mel did, 34 ohms resistor minus J24, there's a way to convert that into a magnitude and an angle. And there are times when being able to convert back and forth between polar form and rectangular form is very handy. The rectangular form, in most people's minds, is easier way to add two vectors. If the two vectors are both rectangular, you add up the reals, you add up the imaginaries, and you know what you got. When it's in polar form, it gives you another piece of information as to what's going on with the phase angles. But if you've got two separate polar vectors, adding them from polar form, I think, is more difficult. Maybe some people think...
Repeater, time out, cancel.
Maybe some people think it's easier, but most people, when you've got two vectors that are in polar form and you want to add them together voltage-wise, and that's what Mother Nature does. When you've got two signals coming from two directions into your antenna, Mother Nature takes the voltage vector of signal number one, as if you're receiving that into your antenna all by itself, the voltage vector of signal number two, as if you're even receiving that into your antenna all by itself, and adds those two voltages. Common sense would lead you to believe that Mother Nature would add those two powers. She doesn't add signals and powers. 99% of the time, she adds voltages. And so adding voltages in polar form, I think, is more difficult. Most people have to convert from polar form to rectangular form to do the addition. But maybe you've got another way of doing it. Because another one of these crappy quadratic equations, and you'll show us another way. Go ahead, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, Roger. This is K2KEY. Well, they brought up a very interesting point. They asked me about, say a little bit more about polar form. I mean, there were some questions. In polar form, you will notice one thing. When you do plot it in polar form, if you plot... you'll notice that as the polar form, the SWR is increasing. Okay, now, when in polar form, or polar notation, very handy, if you have an inductance in series with a resistor, you will find that working many times in polar form is simpler. I believe that is a correct statement, Dick. Would you also believe if you're looking for something in scalar magnitude or phase angle, especially if an inductor in series with a resistor, it'd be easier to solve in polar form? Over.
I'm not sure about that one. That's a function of which way you're more comfortable. I find that I'm more comfortable in the rectangular form, and so if I've got a known signal coming out of a coax cable, that then is going to go to a series inductor and a shunt capacitor and so on, I tend to solve that in rectangular form. I'll admit the mathematics, if I had to do it with pencil and paper, would be a bit hairy. Thank goodness I've got a handheld calculator. Like, for instance, your original starting antenna impedance, 100 ohms plus J0, the way I do that in my calculator is just put in open parentheses, 100, comma, 0, closed parentheses. That's the form that Hewlett-Packard wants to see it in for a complex quantity. two numbers separated by a comma inside of a great big set of ordinary parentheses. And then once you've got them into the machine, I can add, subtract, multiply, divide, take square roots, log, whatever. And it figures out what to do. If I had to do that manually, I'll admit it's hard. And so doing it manually, maybe I'd want to go over to the polar form. Lucky for me, I've got the machine that does that work for me. So that may differ from individual to individual, Mel. I tend to do it polar, correction, rectangular. I sense that you tend to do it polar. And which is better? You like blondes and I like brunettes. And we're both right. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Okay, really, this is K2KEY. Really, the question really arises that you're, say, at an antenna location, and you quickly want to determine a number of, you know, factors, and you have a simple handheld calculator or pocket, you know, calculator, nothing too sophisticated. What can you do? In other words, what can you determine if, for instance, you make measurements with your handheld antenna analyzer and move it around, for instance, to different frequencies and to see, for instance, what the SWR will be, you know, the change in the antenna. And in a case like this, you know, I can't sit down, you know, with a Smith chart in this case, but if you have, for instance, you want to do it in polar form, you can solve, again, you can solve the SWR very simply using the quadratic method. I think I went through that last week. But if you wanted to know the vector, for instance, the angle, and then see if you, like I say, making measurements, and you want to see the change of the angle, which will, again, as the angle increases, the SWR increases, you can do it fairly simple. Because if, for instance, I had a measurement here of one of the next questions who are here, I have an end measurement of 40 plus J0. If you use the formula for Z equals resistance times square root of R squared plus X squared, it's got to equal 50 ohms. So if I took 40, if I got a measurement of 40 plus J, so to see if that measurement is filled. Sorry if I took a button. If I wanted to see, I'm trying to get this out in the right words. If I wanted to see, for instance, that this measurement of 40 plus J0 is basically a correct measurement on my antenna, R squared plus X squared. So in other words, if I took 40 squared plus 30 squared, I would get the square root of 1600 plus 900. In other words, it would give me the square root of 2500, which will be 50. So I know my measurement is correct, but this is actually, we're doing this now in polar form. Am I correct, Dick? Maybe I'm saying it wrong. Over.
Yeah, your 40 squared plus 30 squared is a 3-4-5 triangle, and the hypotenuse is going to be 50, and yes, the total impedance is 50. But you got to be careful in that case. Just because the total impedance is 50 doesn't mean that it is a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio when connected to a 50-ohm cable. Because as you said, it's got an angle to it, and the angle is going to make the visual high. The fact that the resistive component, 30, tells me right away you've got a reasonably high visual, which I can plug into my favorite formula, which I'm about to do, and I'm going to make a guess as to what that standing wave ratio is. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, well, I just wanted to keep this simple. This is K2KEY. I'm just showing, like you say, Z will equal 50. The idea is just to demonstrate that it doesn't mean that it's going to have, like you say, a low SWR. This is not the factor. The factor is to determine whether you made a fairly correct measurement. So now, if you wanted to see now the SWR, the effect of the SWR, what we can do now, again, using a very simple calculator that has a tangent, that has the sine function, the tangent function, geometric function, we can take the tangent of minus 1 over 30 over 40. other words, take the reactants and divide it by the 40, the resistance, so that we got the tangent of minus 1 will be 0.750. And that will come out to an angle of 36.87 degrees. Now, with that, if we are making measurements there and we're shifting the frequency and we're seeing a change in our resistance and our reactance, we can, by just doing it, by this method, see the change in the angle, then determine whether or not, you know, the change in our SWR, which way is it going, up or down. In this case, you can visualize the as the angle is changing. I hope I said that right, Dick, over.
Yeah, I'm not quite sure now what's changing the angle. I guess the antenna started off as 40 resistive, 30 reactive, and so one way to change the phase angle would be to change the ratio of the 30 divided by 40. You take the arctans of that, and yes, you end up with that 36 degrees number. I've already erased it off my machine. But if you change that ratio of 30 to 40, such that the ratio becomes larger, it'll be a larger tangent angle, and the standing wave ratio, I believe, would be increasing in that case. K2RIW.
Roger, that's it. So you, now you can visualize that which way your SWR is going by to see the angle, the way it's changing. Now, if you want to determine the exact SWR at this point, we're getting back now to that quadratic equation that I mentioned. If we took the 40 plus 30, and we went ahead and substituted, now, first we'd have to normalize it, go back to normalizing by dividing it by 50, so we would come out to 0.8 plus J.6. Now, with the quadratic equation that I mentioned last week, again, I got another question, where do you get this from? I don't know how many times people have asked, they cannot find this in any book. I don't remember. I think it may have come when I was in Brooklyn Tech. I maybe one of the professors, the teachers there, came up with it, and I copied it down, but I've had it for many years. So if you want to use that formula, again, I'll repeat the formula, it's SWR is equal to B like in boy plus square root B squared minus 4, and it's divided, all divided by 2. Again, SWR is equal to B, like for boy, plus square root by 2. Now, to solve for B, you got to solve for boy B, is equal to J squared plus 1 divided by R, close brackets, then plus R. Again, B is equal, open bracket, J squared plus 1 over R, close bracket, plus R. So if we use this substitution in here, you'll see for this particular measurement of 40 plus J 30, we'll wind up with an SWR of, if you want me to go down and solve it for you, you know, step by step, but it works out, you'll see the SWR will equal 2.0, Dick, over.
It's 2.0000, exactly. And yes, that equation, quadratic equation, is where you've got an equation where there's ax squared plus bx plus c equals 0. And you want to solve for x. And it's b plus or minus the square root of b squared minus 4ac over 2a. And so you don't have the a's in there. And what you've done is a beautiful way of taking complex mathematics, removing all the complex factors and ending up with nothing but squares and square roots. So for a person who doesn't have a calculator that can handle complex, you know, reals and imaginaries, this is a beautiful way to do it. The canonical way, the way that it's taught in many colleges today, is that you take your impedance, which in this case is 40 plus J30, and let's call that Z. Z is our impedance. It happens to be plus 40 ohms and 30 ohms of positive J. But you take Z minus Z0, which happens to be 50 ohms. So Z minus Z0 divided by Z plus Z0, that equals the reflection coefficient. Some people get driven up a wall with that jazz. You've eliminated all the complex. You've got it right down to the bare minimum of just doing square roots and squares. And it works. Fantastic. And I haven't seen it in any book. I've never seen it before. Most of the people in the sound of your voice have never heard it. I'll bet you some little old smart guy at Brooklyn Poly, at Brooklyn Tech High School on DeKalb Avenue invented that. He got rid of all the complex jazz, got it down to the bare minimum. He never published an article on it, so therefore no one else has ever seen it except the students that have gone to Brooklyn Tech High School. That's what I think is going on here, Mel. K2KUY and K2RIW in the Tech Man.
This is K2KUY. You know, I don't remember. For the life of me, I don't remember where I got this from. I've had it so many years, I don't remember if I seen it there, seen some form of it there, broke it down, worked with it, or myself, and come up with the final way of doing this. But I found, gee, this is so simple, real quick. And they stood there in puzzlement. Why didn't I think of that? Gee, look what I'm going through here. And literally was solving lightning speeds compared to, like you say, what they were going through, the complex math. And at the end, then I questioned them. I said, are you sure the answer is correct? Well, let me look at it. And a few of them, after they went through, oh, yeah, I think so. And I said, well, I'll say that it is incorrect. And I said, do it again. And when they did it again, they had come up with another answer, and they said, well, I think this, I said, read my answer. How the heck did you do it so fast? So I've got a number of mathematical, you know, ways of doing a number of complex engineering problems, and I don't understand why they always teach it so complicated, a lot of things. You're not going to remember. How the heck are you going to sit? You got to sit and, like you say, take a lot of notes, put it into calculators and things, but a lot of times, you know, you need something real quick and something simple. And so too many things go around the, as they say, the mulberry bush, Dick. So I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong, but I don't know. To me, I've talked to a lot of younger engineers, and I don't think they are getting the right way of learning anymore. Maybe the old times that professors are all gone, but the new ones are, I could say, doing it by the book, step by step, and it's too complicated over.
WB2HWW with a comment.
Go ahead, Howie.
Right now, it's doing it is so simple. When you multiply and divide, when you're adding and dividing, you know, when you got the angles, you got to remember to take the sign and the angle in the denominator. You know all that. I'll tell you, this is so much easier, Dick. I mean, he has an easy formula.
Why in the world didn't Howard Seidman, I think it was Professor High Seidman, K2BUS, how come he didn't teach us, you and me, this way, Howie?
I think he liked
me. Professor Helm, who used to teach us freshman calculus. Do you remember the way Helm used to fill up the whole left-hand board, then the whole middle board, and then the whole right-hand board with the neatest-looking mathematics in the world? Do you remember Professor Helm, who taught us freshman calculus, the guy with an extraordinary...
Absolutely. He was a nice guy, by the way. Yeah. He lived near the campus. He also liked to have a couple fifth courses in a while. That guy was a really nice guy, but man, I took it for advanced calculus. He could really blow your mind. He was very knowledgeable. He made you like the stuff. He really digged the math, Dick. He really was into it.
And boy, did he have a sense of humor. I can remember one particular student who became a little bit frustrated, and the student, half in a joke, sat in the second row in that first floor of the engineering building with those wooden desks on that wooden floor, and the guy took out a cap pistol. But it wasn't obvious that it was a cap pistol. He took out a cap pistol, and he aimed it straight at Professor Helm, standing in front of the class. And Helm said, I came from the Midwest. I've seen guns. They don't bother me. He turned around and kept right on writing. That's a sense of humor. Yeah, these were earlier times. This is before terrorism became popular. This is way before 9/11. I'm describing an incident that occurred in 1963. So these were very different times. But can you imagine Professor Helm having a gun aimed at him, and he turned around and said, I come from the Midwest. I'm not afraid of guns. And he kept right on writing. Back to you, Howie.
I got a better question to ask you. What happened to the guy? Did he get expelled?
Nothing happened. Nothing happened. The student did it with a smile on his face. You could get away with that as humor in 1963. Those were very different times. Nowadays, you take out even a cap pistol in a class and aim it at a professor. Wow. My son went to the University of Iowa a few years ago. It wasn't well advertised, but a year before my son had arrived, a student walked across campus with a rifle in hand, walked into a major lecture room, aimed it at the head of the professor, and fired. Left blood all over the place, killed him instantly, turned around and walked out. Those are very different times. Obviously, the student didn't get away with it. He had lost his mind. There was a zillion witnesses to the scene and so on, and he's incarcerated today, and the professor is dead. So things like this happen on college campuses, and they don't get into the newspapers, or at least not into the national news, and that's what happened at the University of Iowa, roughly, oh, I would guess 1996 or so. Thank you, Howie.
I would guess the guy was unbalanced. I mean, there's nothing that should drive someone to do that, but yeah, I can see some of this stuff getting pretty hairy. Boy, yet, I mean, there's people, I was a little bit after you, but we had some instructors that really would throw the stuff at you. But I think, yeah, I think what Mel is doing is showing you to do it in a very simpler way. I mean, I like polar rectangulars for some reason. I like to put everything in polar rectangle. That way I know the magnitude and I know the angle. And if I know the plus or the minus, I know if it's leading or lagging the current, obviously. I don't know, I get more information when I see something like at 5 at minus 53 or 5 at plus 53 degrees, because then I know what's happening. I know that the magnitude is 5 and I know the angle. So I have a much more of a visualization. So, everything in polar. Other people like staying rectangular, you know, half a dozen the other, Dick.
Yep. Okay, so you're another polar person. You and Mel think alike. I'm a little bit more rectangular. Each has its advantages. And so you choose your method and stick with it and learn all the quirks of that particular method, and you can make it fly. I can remember on a number of occasions whenever you're adding positive and negative numbers, some people will say, okay, I'm adding. And what I'll do is I'll take the difference between the positive number and the negative number and then give it the sign, the answer, give it the sign of what's the larger number. That's the way some people do it. Other people do it by, if it's a subtraction, they'll reverse the sign of the thing that's being subtracted and then add the two together. Whether you add plus and minus number or subtract a pair of positive numbers, as long as you know what you're doing, you can make either method work. So I'm slowly concluding that probably more of the world likes polar than rectangular, Mel. Maybe I'm one of the oddballs that sticks in a little bit more rectangular. You got it, Mel.
Just let me make one comment because this is important on the extra test.
Go ahead.
You know, on the extra test, it'll give you an RLC circuit. It'll give you resistance. It'll give you inductance, capacitance. They'll ask you, is it the voltage leading, the voltage current adding? And the trick that I have, because I've been showing people how to do this, if you just look to see which is larger, if the capacitor is larger, it's negative. If the inductor is larger, it's positive, you know, it's positive. Is voltage leading the current? If you have a minus sign, is current leading, you know, if voltage lagging. Very interesting way to do that, and you can actually do it on a test, you know. They made the extra test pretty hard, Dick. You know what I tell you? This is something you should know. On the extra test, they ask you, what is nodal analysis? Because I've been, you know, helping out the Hall of Science. And I happen to see, I was reading the questions online, one of the questions, and I'm wondering, who is making up these DEC questions to ask you, what is nodal analysis? Can you believe that on a ham test?
Well, the extra test does have to be a lot tougher than the advanced used to be, and the general, and the novice, and the technician, because that's the way to separate the men from the boys. It's the way to justify all the extra privileges you get with the extra, and there's no longer a 20 word per minute code speed. Even the 5 has been disappeared, and as such, it's going to be a tougher test. And yeah, all the nitty-gritty of electronics ain't easy. And that's the bottom line. You can graduate summa cum laude with a bachelor degree from a darn good school, and you think you're a good electronic engineer. And I've recently was involved with the hiring of a summa cum laude from a Purdue University in Indiana. Or is it Illinois? Indiana, yes. And he's been working with us now for 6 months. But it's amazing how much hands-on experience he has to be given in the real world to do real electronic engineering on microwave circuits. It takes a significant apprenticeship. And I'm not even convinced that you can get the required apprenticeship at the master's level. I'm even skeptical whether you can get it at the doctorate level. I bet you of all the people that Mel has hired, I bet you it takes them a couple of years of giving these guys all kinds of hints and kinks to know how to solve real engineering problems in the real engineering world. Very different than the book learning. I'm a little bit saddened by that because a good student in computer science and computer engineering can come out of the school in a very short period of time and be productive. A guy who wants to be an RF engineer, it seems to me he's going to require a couple of years of additional apprenticeship in order to learn the skills to do that particular occupation. I'm not quite sure what the corrective action required is, but some kind of corrective action is required because schools are not giving enough information in that area. That's my opinion. I bet you've seen something like
proposed this. This is K2KEY. I'm going to tell you about an experience. Well, not too long ago, about the extra class license and all. An experience. I'm going to put it to you really in a way that's going to be hard to believe, but if I didn't really see it with my own eyes and experience. I know of a 12-year-old that passed the extra class license. Happened to be a young lady, very, very, very bright young lady. And I know the family. The father, the mother, are not quite interested in electronics, but they are professors. They are very brilliant people also. And the daughter, she happened to get from somebody, I think was a friend of the family, an amplifier. About a linear amplifier, about, I'd say it was about 12 years old, using a pair of 3-500s, was made by, I believe it was Drake was putting it out. I think it was the name. It was a Drake amp. And she was in there toddling around. I said, "What are you doing?" And she says, "Well, I want to check to see." I said, "Why are you doing this with the power?" Oh, she says, "It's in standby position. Doesn't that mean just the filaments are lit?" I says, "No, my darling, absolutely not. Your hand does not belong in there while the plug is even in the wall." And I says, "Not only do you take the plug out of the wall, but you see this cap on here? You get a clip lead from the casing and you ground that cap. Because," I said, "these reserves of charge and these condensers are lethal." I says, "Do you know what you're playing around with here?" She thought this is the safest solid-state amplifiers that she's fooled with, made little projects and all. And I said to myself, this, they're handing out licenses and things like this. Where is the knowledge to convey to these kids and people that there's a lot more to it, that you just can't dive into any of this equipment, just like Dick was just mentioning? It takes time to learn. It takes time to understand what you're dealing with and all. But I'll tell you, I shudder. I just shudder that this is being repeated who knows how many times. I don't want to see young amateurs or people even older getting hurt or killed, that amateur radio is going to get a bad name because these people are not coming up from the so-called ranks and learning step by step. They're jumping ahead. It's just like if I plucked you off the street tomorrow and say, "Dick, you know how to drive a car. Why not we take you over and you'll drive a 747? What's the difference? It's basically the same piece of equipment. I mean, it'll be kind of ridiculous, Dick, over."
That's why in the good old days you had a novice for one, you're only allowed to run 75 watts. That is scary, because they think everything is solid state, even at the FCC. You know, they think all you gotta do is get a solid fish. I'm lucky you would get me if you saved a life. Over to you, Dick.
Yeah, that's quite a case. And what you're saying, Mel, is that, both Mel and Howie are saying, is that the modern day volunteer examiner question pool apparently is making the assumption that everything nowadays is solid state, and there's a lot of high-powered tube amplifiers around, and they're running on 800 to 2,000 and sometimes 3,000 volts on the plate. And as such, without some special instruction, you can get yourself into a lot of trouble. The amplifier itself, in most cases, has some kind of a default switch or a switch that when you open the cabinet, the B plus is turned off. A well-designed one has that. Well, let's face it, anybody with a little bit of smarts can easily bypass that switch and find ways of operating the amplifier with the cover off, with the B plus turned on. I can remember the times when I used to take my pair of 807s on 20 meters and get great thrill out of putting a pencil to the plate cap and drawing a great big purple arc for about 3/4 of an inch or so when the amplifier was running at the 150 watt level. And yes, in the process of building that thing when I was 17 years old, I did manage to touch the 800 volt secondary winding on that transformer once. And lucky for me, I survived that. And where my fingers touched that wire, one hand was on the chassis and the other fingers were touching the wire right at the end of the insulation. And between my thumb and my index finger, I raised two high white lumps of dead flesh that existed for the next couple of weeks. And lucky for me, the resistance through my body, through those fingers, was just high enough that it didn't send me into fibrillation. Because I guarantee the family would not have known me in the basement was sitting there in the fibrillated condition slowly dying. And did people know defibrillating procedures, a CPR procedure in 1957? No way. So I came close to dying from just a similar situation like that. And in those days, they taught you more about high voltage in the exams. One of us has come close to dying on a couple of occasions with high voltage, with automobiles, with towers, and so on. There's risk. And how do you get all that information across to somebody to respect those risks and take the proper precautions? Darn good question. It takes some form of apprenticeship. It takes some kind of an Elmer saying, I'm going to hold your hand for a while, and I'm going to lead you through the through the forest here, and I'm going to show you where the bad animals are. I'm going to show you where the dangers are. Without somebody holding you by the hand, you're at an awful lot of risk. K2KEY. K2LIW.
Remind me of a Clay Venus, Dick.
I understand. Go ahead, Mel.
Oh, yeah, you're right. That's the correct way an amplifier of that type should be designed, but you're not going to find other than when Collins made the amplifiers, like the KWS-1, you open the front lid, the front of the panel there, it actually snaps off the front. First of all, it's got a lock on it that you can lock it, and actually has a key lock. But if you open it, there's a bar that falls down across the filter capacitors at the same time the interlock switch opens. So they, yes, they went ahead and they did a lot of precautions, but you only found that, you know, in the high-end piece of equipment. And like you said, it's easily jumped. But just like Howie said, you know, they're taking kids, these young people that should start out as a novice and learn step by step, you know, get the experience. And, you know, you see it, whatever it be, at field day, you get young people down there and all, and if you, you know, you got to keep an eye on them when it comes to putting up antennas and things. And the only other case I knew of, thankfully, I haven't had any really bad experiences where I've been in any way physically hurt. The only thing is I did get tattooed, believe it or not. Boy, that was a funny one. I had a red test lead from the meter, the red lead, draped over my forearm, and I touched it to a source of RF, and it fried right through the wire, fried right through, and tattooed a line, a red line on my arm that was there for many years. The dye of, in the cable, in the wire, transferred into my skin. So I got tattooed that way. That was my first tattoo, Dick. I won't tell you about the second one. Anyhow, no, but I know of, yes, many years ago, fact, I got the article here. There was a picture of, in fact, in QST of a young man that went ahead and threw his antenna wire over the high tension line in front of his house, putting a bend, and lost both of his arms. And we try to be supportive of him, sending him QSL cards, you know, wishing him all good luck and everything. But the article shows that he, you know, he never was cautioned on the test or anything. That's what they got in the beginning of the manual. Switch to safety. But why are these questions? Throw in a few safety questions just to maybe wake up their mind so that they are aware that there is high voltage. If not everything is running off a 9-volt or a 12-volt battery or some goddamn thing that you can poke your hands into, Dick, over.
I can remember climbing a tree in front of a neighbor's house where I lived in Farmingdale, and I was at an altitude where I could have reached over and touched the Long Island Lighting Company lines that were at the same altitude. They had cut a hole through the tree where the lighting company line went through, and I'm climbing a tree and I'm on a branch very close to it. Thankfulness I didn't go over and touch it. And some of those lines are not even insulated. And yeah, the 2300 or 7600 is there. And when you're on a tree and the tree itself has got conductive sap inside and it's well grounded, you climb on a tree and touch that wire, you're in a lot of trouble. We've all come close a few times to getting ourselves in quite a bit of trouble. And thank goodness we've survived it. And now we're trying to pass on that information about what safety is required. And Hiram Percy Maxim, arguably the founder of American Radio Relay League, I believe he died of electrocution because the earphones he was wearing had a wire come across the high voltage transformer and electrocuted him right through the head. I think he died. I think the founder of ham radio died from a high voltage incident. Does that seem reasonable from your memory, Mel? Go ahead.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Oh, I have no idea. Okay, we're in repeater mode. You know, I have no idea. I never knew that. Gee, Dick, that is news to me. I didn't realize that's what he died of, over.
I think so. I wonder if you've heard that story, Howie.
This, but I can tell you that I got hit by a 500 or 1,000 volt from a flip tap on a Clay Zener single side battery. It had a 6883. I think I went in there to try to neutralize something, and man, did I see stars for a couple of hours at stage.
Yes, you got to. And we've all played with high voltage. The thing I did when I first built my 4CX250 amplifier, I built a 2,000 volt power supply. I wanted to test it to see if it could tolerate a quarter of an amp of load. I remember putting those two clip leads onto two metal strips into a great big bowl of water, and that was going to be the dummy load, just for the power supply. And I was going to pour salt into the water until it was conductive enough to draw the right amount of current. And I found out real fast that the mineral matter in the water that came out of the well from my home was more than enough conductive, and I did a bunch of experiments with slowly connecting, slowly drawing those leads out of the water while watching the steam arc over and so on. When I think about it now, it's a fairly dangerous experiment, even though in those days I was smart enough to make sure I was using very thick leads with a lot of insulation, only touching one wire at a time, having the other hand in my pocket while I'm reaching this thing into the bowl of water. Still, I should have been doing it with a great big long stick to be one step closer to the safe. But I saw some interesting arcing phenomena at 2,000 volts with boiling water. But when I think about it now, I still own that amplifier and that power supply. A rather dangerous experiment. 2,000 volts can get you in a lot of trouble. Thank goodness I never touched that particular supply. It was only the very first one I ever built back in 1957, where I put my hand across the 800-volt transformer. And that was AC. I think AC is a little bit safer when it comes to fibrillation, but I ain't sure. Because that happened from hand to hand, I think I came close to buying the farm that day. Back to you, Mel.
AC is a lot more dangerous, Dick.
You're probably right. In fact, Westinghouse versus Edison had a great big running argument as to which is more dangerous to human beings and which one do you run an electric chair with. AC or DC. They're both darn dangerous, and they'll both cook you and send you into fibrillation under the worst conditions. Back to you, Bill.
Ever hear of that experiment, that thing that they did here in Coney Island with the elephants?
No, tell us about it.
Well, that's what happened. Edison came down with his generator, and they had an elephant here that was abused. They used to have an elephant that used to walk around. They used to have in place here in Coney Island. The place was called Dreamland, and they had a number of wild animals. I mean, bears, elephants that would walk around, and that the people could pet them and everything. They're supposed to be tame animals. Well, this poor one elephant, somebody was thought they were cute, stuck a cigarette into its trunk. As you stick out its trunk, you know, people give it peanuts and things like that. This guy stuck a cigarette in there, and the elephant went crazy and killed him. So to get rid of the elephant, Edison says, well, the best way was to electrocute him. He brought down generators, and they chained this poor elephant to this power plant, and they electrocuted him with DC over.
And I presume the elephant died with DC equally as fast as he would have with AC. Is that true?
No, it was, Edison was trying, they was both AC and DC. Edison was trying to prove that DC was safer than AC at the time. That's when, you know, remember, he was going back and forth with Hertz, I think it was AC, but with AC and DC. Remember, Edison was strictly a DC man. He didn't want the AC to come into really into existence. So that's what they did, this thing. And yeah, the pictures, I saw the movie. The pictures that were taken, this was about 1905 or something, before World War One. Today, of course, you'd never get away with a thing like that, but you should see the smoke that was coming out of the poor elephant, over.
Edison was strongly in favor of DC. Tesla and Westinghouse both were strongly in favor of AC. And I think the biggest argument was between Edison and Tesla. Tesla thought AC was the right way to go. So the elephant did die, and did they subject the elephant to both AC and DC, or only DC when he died, Mel? Go ahead.
They did a number of times. They killed horses, they killed cows, they did all kinds of things. So this was the ultimate, was to kill the elephant, to kill an elephant, the biggest animal, land animal, with DC, and to see how long he'd take to die. Edison claimed that it would take longer for him to die with DC than AC. That was, oh, I'm telling you. But this guy Edison, sometimes I lose a lot of respect for him, over.
WB2HWW. DC, the reason why DC is more dangerous is that your muscles contract. In AC, you're going to be able to repel off the wires. They always tell you that if you get hooked by DC, it's hard for you to pull away because you contract it.
Yeah, I can see how either one can get you in an awful lot of trouble. I visited Edison's summer laboratory, and that laboratory he had down there was doing some extremely good work in a lot of areas. Although he's not a perfect person, still he had 1,072 patents. His best year, he had 75 patents filed in just 1 year, and he did a lot of good work in all kinds of areas. Making a factory that generates cement for production of concrete, and lots of biological experiments with rubber and methods of making rubber during wartime shortage areas, as well as things that we know about with reference to light bulbs and cameras and phonographs. And he was a pretty busy guy, and the way he hired people was also an interesting technique. He would promise them he said, if you work for me, you'll work long hours, you'll get very little pay, you'll get very little recognition, and you'll work very hard, and you'll work 6 or 7 days a week. If a person could pass that as an entrance exam, he knew he had a good, loyal employee. Back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
And he had his superiority. Like, he slept on a desk, and it was a roll-top desk, and he used to roll it down, desk that he had underneath the staircase. in the lab, and he rolled the desk when he wanted to take a snooze to get on that desk and push down and roll up and go to sleep. It was like a little private cabin. He also would walk hunched over, you know, bent over, and they look at him and say, well, he did that purposely just because he'd only have to straighten up and bend over again. So why, if he had to go from one place to the other, why shouldn't he walk hunched over? He must have been a strange person, to say the least. And, you know, the only power supply, you mentioned power supplies, the only one that really scares the heck out of me. I'm very, very cautious. I have a couple of big supplies, but the biggest one I have is my Collins. And that supply is 4,039.39 at 1.6 amps. That power supply I would never want to come in contact with. That's the what Collins has on this kilowatt transmitter. I don't know where they, you know, they didn't know what the heck to do, how big to make the thing, and they just went the ultimate over.
Yeah, they sure did a good job. I was at a meeting of the Astronomical Society of Long Island about 2 years ago, which meets at New York Institute of Technology. And behind the building, they were throwing out a bunch of stuff they were no longer using. So I did some dumpster diving, and in there was this beautiful electrostatic high-voltage voltmeter, which has got three ranges on it, up to 8,000 volts on one scale, and the highest scale goes to 30,000 volts. So I was having some fun during the week taking my Wimshurst generator and connecting the two wires from the Wimshurst generator, where the two spheres normally arc over, connecting them to this electrostatic voltmeter. And I found out that my Wimshurst generator will generate 29 kilovolts, very little current, but it makes a nice, enthusiastic that generator on the way that I purchased this week by mail order. And it's claimed to go up to 200 kilovolts. Watching the corona effects of high voltage in a darkened room can give you some very interesting understanding of where precipitation static comes from. When I first moved into this current house and I first put up my 100-foot tower, for the first 5 years, whenever an approaching thunderstorm would come along, I would hear a very raspy tick-tick-tick sound that eventually rose up to about a 3KC raspy note and an S9 signal level. And it's because of high voltage building up around the tower. And one day I was up the tower and I saw the actual corona taking place from the tips of all the elements of the 432 Yagi. It wasn't until I got smarter later on and put a taller mast out of the top of the tower that I lowered that effect. But you'd be amazed how many times a cloud passing by your house will put some pretty high voltage into your neighborhood, particularly if you're running a 100-foot tower sitting on top of a 300-foot hill, which is my QTH. Back to you, Mel, KQRIW.
Funny, I picked up a meeting, you mentioned something. I meant to ask if you ever seen a thing like this. Very old meeting, it's in a wooden case, and it's got a meter on it that also goes into the kilovolts way up there, and it's got a hand crank on it, a very cute thing, the way this hand crank folds out of the wooden cabinet. In other words, for storage, the hand crank tilts in, the top cover folds open, really beautifully finished like piece of wood. And it's got two, I don't have the probes, it looks like two probes must have come out of it. And it hooks, I don't know where the probes went or what, but you can see they're using, you know, nice porcelain insulated. And it's in kilovolts up to, I think, 50 kV with a hand crank. And I cranked it, and boy, it does. It puts out quite a bit. Now, I don't know, did you ever see an instrument like that? What do you think its use was, Dick? Over.
I think it's a high pot insulation tester. I'll bet you if you open up that case, you're going to see a Wimshurst generator in there, or you're going to see a hand-cranked Van de Graaff generator, one or the other. And if that can make 50 kilovolts, that's a fun instrument to have. You can do some very interesting experiments in that. You go to the website that I can give you addresses for where you start looking at high-voltage experiments of what you can do with a thing like that. I'd love to know what's inside of there. Is it a hand-cranked Van de Graaff generator or a hand-cranked Wimshurst generator? The Wimshurst is the one that looks like two phonograph records rotating in opposite direction. The Van de Graaff generator is the one that looks like a rubber bolt between two pulleys with two high-voltage fences that pick up the electrons that are being emitted by the thing. But each of those can make lots of tens of kilovolts, if not hundreds of kilovolts. So I think that's an insulation tester you've got there. And what's nice about my electrostatic voltmeter is it draws no current while measuring voltage. It's just got two Hudson valve-like movement. And so it draws no current. I can set my Wimshurst generator up to 28 kilovolts and watch the voltage stay on there for tens of minutes. We're getting very close to when the machine's going to cut us off now. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, very good. Yeah, I once went someplace and was up in the Bronx, and this place had a lot of surplus stuff. All kinds of stuff. And I bought that. I don't know what. I never opened it up. It just looked nice box and everything. It had a nice meter that it looked like in there that I bought. I don't remember. I paid a few dollars. Then I bought another thing, some kind of magnet. It's a meter that detects magnetism. I don't know what the heck that was used for. It's also, that's what it is. It says on it something. I see when you bring a magnet near it, the needle swings one way. I bought a number of these different things. All right, we'll discuss it sometime in the future. Yet the repeater's just about to shut down. Okay, 73 is all. Thank you very much for joining us here on the TechNet, and I'll try to answer as many emails as possible, and best 73s from me. Back over to you, Dick.
I'm amazed that you'll make that promise, Mel. 75 guys writing to you per week. Wow. You must have an awful lot of patience. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. I'd love to know what's inside of your high-voltage thing. And that other thing that measures magnetic field, it's probably a Gauss meter. And there's a lot of different ways of doing that. Hall effect device is one of the nicest ways. But that would require a separate power supply to run it. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. K2RIW TechNet Mylock, and Mel and I are closing down TechNet number 1128. Of the series that began in September of 1982. See you all.
Have a great week, Dick. K2RIW,
WD2HW. What'd you say, Howie? Is there something else you want to say?
Yes, just have a great week, and I'll speak to you next week, maybe.
Okay, bye-bye.
The time is 12 a.m. 73, and good night from the W2VL repeater.